Thank you. So Yeshua, in case you didn't get it, that's Jesus. that's the Hebrew name. That was his actual, that's closer to what his name sounded like. I took a class in seminary, and the professor made us say Joshua or Josh for Jesus. I think that it's like so many religious words, even that name has become just kind of saddled and weighted with all of these strange accretions. For some of us, it may bring soothing relief or excitement or interest or passion. And for others, even that word Jesus, God, some of these names kind of hit us like something that's kind of irritating. It's kind of like a screech or a scratch or a something strange. So I found this translation, and he kept all of those place names, those Hebrew names. And I'm one of those people who find some of these words strange, so it shook it up. Does anyone have any good jokes about death? Seriously. Yeah? Yeah. Seriously.
Why did the first koala fall out of the tree?
I don't know.
Why? Why did the second koala fall out of the tree?
Why?
The first one hit it when it was falling. Why did the third koala fall out of the tree?
Some people are getting really sad right now. Why?
Peer pressure.
That's good. Thank you. That touches on deep universal themes.
Yeah.
Thank you, Caroline. I've heard a couple famous comedians tell like jokes about death. One is Aziz Ansari. People know Aziz. He did this special recently at where's like Radio City Music Hall or something, or
MSG,
Madison Square Garden. Yeah, big special. And the final joke, the culminating joke of his whole set. Has anyone seen it? Tim, you've seen it? Yeah. So you know this joke. The final joke is he's talking about relationships and how when you're in one, you kind of wish you were single. And when you're single, all you want is to be in a relationship. And he's like, so he's talking about being single. And then he's like, and then finally you get in a relationship. And it's great. You found this person. You're together. And it's wonderful. You're on cloud nine. And then after a while, it's a little boring, or like you get into routines, and then you get married, and it's exciting again, and yeah. And then you go on your honeymoon, and it's great, and then after a while, you kind of get in a slump, a routine again. But then you have a kid, and it's great, and they're wonderful, and he kind of keeps going through this eventually. And your wife gets older, and you're getting older, and she gets sick, and then she dies, and then it's horrible, and then you're getting older, and you start to get sick, and then you can't walk, and you're frail, but you get to ride an electric scooter around New York, and it's great! Eh? Like, and that's the end of the joke. And I like want to give props to Aziz because it's a pretty good joke, but something about it left me feeling a little bit like it was not quite enough. Because he didn't go there. I mean, he points to it. He kind of you see that your own death, the first person death, is what comes next. But he doesn't go there. And I think his point is one that we're pretty familiar with, because he's kind of trying to have it both ways, make a kind of dark joke, but also say something profound, which is that little things like electric wheelchairs or scooters riding around, like that's the stuff that makes life worth living, the little stuff, right? We've all heard that. And I think that kind of view of death, where we kind of know it's there, we don't really want to quite look at it, and like, remember, the small stuff is what makes life meaningful. There's something true about it. Yes, the small stuff is meaningful, but this not quite looking at death, I think, is something I want to look at a little bit more. Louis C.K., who's kind of my personal favorite comedian right now, he also told a joke that I saw recently on his show Louis, and it was, everyone wants to know what happens after death. Like, what's life? What happens after you die? What's going on? He's like, well, tons of shit happens. Lots happens. Just you're not there for any of it. There's a Super Bowl every year. There's like a dog catching a frisbee. Like, but you're not there. which is a little darker and I think a little truer. That's why I kind of like Louis. I think he really goes for the jugular. But again, it's, I think with Louis too, we see kind of another philosophy that's common of kind of a heroic, courageous facing of the fact that death is the end. There's nothing beyond it. That's sort of maybe the first one of kind of like, well, we don't really know what happens with death. It's sort of this, we can't experience it, might as well not really be afraid of it, enjoy the little things. That's pretty close to what the Greeks, like the Epicurean school of Greek philosophy, thought about death. And this kind of heroic facing down until death doesn't really scare you anymore, until it's sort of, you're sort of overcome the narrow self that would be afraid of such things and realize that your identity is much bigger than that. It's not really your own. Again, death, that's kind of a Stoic philosophy. It's a little bit like, there's this new philosopher I like, Mark Johnston, who talks about that the reason we're afraid of death is because we don't know what we are. If we realize what we really are, which is not just in this body, but if we're able to kind of overcome ourselves, it's in everyone whose life we touch, and they live on beyond our death, then death shouldn't be so scary. And there's something to that too. So the Christian way of looking at this, which I'm kind of going to make a case for, first of all, I think those two ways, those aren't just shallow ways of looking at life and death. That's the point. There are these whole schools of philosophy that sort of taught them and said that's the way to a rich, meaningful life. It wasn't just like, sing, dance, be merry, don't worry about it. But the Christian way is a little different. And it has to do with this concept of resurrection. Which is another word that is like, what does that mean? One of the questions I want to ask is, can we really look at death? Can we actually know what we're talking about? Can we kind of summon it in a sort of imaginative experience? Can we think about it really rationally and stare it square in the eye, heroically and courageously? Can we do that? Can we actually do that? These schools of philosophy say we can. I think the Christian school of philosophy, theology, living says we can't do it alone. We can't actually know what death is. We can't summon it. We can't heroically face it on our own. There's an author and poet I really like. He's kind of popular around here. Christian Wiman said that when he was younger, he was a poet. And there's this thing in poetry and philosophy that to really see beauty, to really feel truth, you need to experience death. You need to be mindful of it. This philosopher Heidegger said, we need to be towards death. That's how we're really alive. And he said when he was younger, that's what he was like. He was like, yeah, I'm down with, like, me and death, like, we're tight. We know, like, I know death. That's where I, when I'm sitting, writing a poem, looking out, I'm like confronting death. Then he got cancer, a rare form of cancer that is untreatable. They can kind of help it subside for a while. He had fallen in love in his late 30s, met the woman of his dreams, and then a year later is when he got his diagnosis. He said when he actually was diagnosed with a life-threatening disease, the kind of death that he had thought he knew, the death that he had been kind of courageously, poetically, artistically summoning and experience, that was nothing. That was a thought in his mind compared to this real experience of diagnosis. Now, I haven't had one of those, and part of what I'm saying is that in order to approach this stuff, this kind of the limits of where we can experience and know, we may need to rely on other people's, like I said before, testimony, other people's sort of reports from the frontier. When I was, I took a year off after high school, before college, a gap year. It's a very European thing to do. I was like a top student in high school, going to this fancy college, and I was like, screw school, man, I don't need school. Like really high on my male self. And I lived for a while in France, and then I lived for 3 months with my aunt and uncle in Italy. And my aunt, my dad's sister, married a man named Lorenzo, it was my uncle. Lorenzo was Peruvian. And to my Norwegian Minnesotan family, he brought this, like, this sounds kind of racist, but like spiciness to my family. Literally, he was an amazing chef. He cooked Peruvian food. There's a story my family tells about my little sister was in kindergarten, and they had to bring a recipe of their favorite food for the kindergarten cookbook. And you know, it was like macaroni and cheese, like hot dogs, like pizza. And my sister's was beef heart. And it was, so like in this Minnetonka, Minnesota, it was like, and so literally we have this cookbook, like this kindergarten cookbook, macaroni and cheese, beef heart. I don't think anyone made it. But he exposed us to not just different foods, but a different way of being. He was so much more vivacious, kind of emotionally on the surface. You could read his emotions on the surface. He would tell these outlandish stories that were like half true, but he was just so intensely alive. He was larger than life. He loved to make people laugh. He was always working on projects. He was an artist. When he was younger, he had been in medical school in Peru. And he told me this story when I stayed with him during that gap year, that the reason he quit was because there came the time to dissect the body. And the instructor or whatever brought out this corpse and was like, you guys are all gonna get your own corpse. You get to dissect it. And the next day he quit. He was like, I am not gonna do that. So he moved to Berkeley, became a painter, married my aunt. We got to hang out a lot when I was living with them. And he would tell me that at night, sometimes he would wake up in the middle of the night and be stricken with terror about his own mortality. I had never heard an adult say this, ever. I don't know if I have heard an adult say that to me since. He was just so honest about it. And I remember I couldn't really relate. I didn't have that experience. I was 18. I didn't know what he was talking about. But I knew it was something big and serious. I think that his fear of death wasn't because he was wimpy. I think in some ways that I think, when I think about it, he was so intensely engaged in life. He was so appreciative and so in love with people and experiences and art that he knew that death was going to mean a loss of those things. That his sort of terror of death was the flip side of his love of life. 6 years later, I was living in China. I'm so cool. I've lived all around the world. Yes. No. It took me a long time to figure out what to do with my life. That's the truth. And I had heard like a month earlier that Lorenzo was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. And so I called the number they gave me. It was my aunt's cell phone. He was in the hospital in Italy. And she put him on the phone. And this vivacious, larger-than-life man was reduced to a quivering voice. I'll never forget. He said, Neil, I'm dying. And I couldn't fully experience that at the time. I have subsequently more. But it occurred to me, I heard the fear. Whereas before he was reporting on the fear that he had felt, this time he was actually reporting from his present experience, which is way different. And I also heard what sounded kind of like embarrassment almost, like he didn't really know. He didn't have a sort of up after it. He didn't have the strength in him. He was just reduced, smaller than life. Some versions of this story that we heard read today, this account, specifically there was one that wasn't in there. You heard from Mark, Luke, and Matthew, and John is the fourth. And John, people describe it as Jesus kind of, it's when Jesus is the most sort of divine, the divine spectrum. He's kind of hovering above everything, all this crazy shit is happening, and he's just like, I know the plan, I'm really God, you know, like, whatever they do to me, like, I'm gonna be good, I'm gonna kind of coast through. In the other three, I'm not saying that there's not good stuff in John, but the other three are much more the human side. We heard Jesus being degraded and spat upon. I think if you read not too between the lines, we sense that Jesus really is ashamed. That when he's being mocked, like this whole thing you planned, even his supporters kind of like, whoa, this is too heavy, they got out. He was alone and reduced and fearful, and I think ashamed. You know, the part we didn't hear, they dress him up as the king, hit him, crown of thorns, all that. He's afraid too, he feels, in those most chilling words, I think, of the whole Bible, my God, why have you abandoned me? Why have you left me here? And fear is kind of, then he's dealing with all the fear of his disciples and their failure to even believe. So like he was not sure that he believed, he died. Even when like they're faced with the risen Lord, at first most of the disciples don't believe either. They're afraid also. And yet, what is remarkable to me about at least one, some of the accounts notice this. The reason I put them together is because it's almost like none of the supposed witnesses who saw this event want to include all of the degradation. They'll each include a little bit, and I kind of put it so that it was all there. So we get Jesus being humiliated, but then also humiliated by one of the criminals, the thieves next to him. And even though he doubts that he is part of this big thing that's gonna end well, he reassures the other criminals, surely today I say to you, you'll be with me in paradise. He's not sure, but he says it anyways. I was talking with someone who came today, who came here because of something that I'm pretty proud of, which is that the denomination that is supporting Root and Branch, it's called the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, has been in the news, the national news lately. I don't know if anyone has seen this. There's an interview with the general minister and president on NPR. It's pretty cool. They're based in Indianapolis. It's their headquarters, and they're going to host their national convention there. And this proposed legislation, the so-called religious freedom stuff, prompted the disciples, the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, to say, we're not going to have our conference here. Yeah, exactly. Thank you. That is good. And I think that beyond the sort of PR problem that religion has in America, what struck me was, and this may be obvious, but it's still worth saying, is that a religion that organizes itself around a God that was degraded, that people found disgusting, that people found, that like hung out with people that society said was disgusting or shameful or not worthwhile, with the message that this whole framework of some people are pure and some people are to stay away from or gross. Just how, again, this seems obvious, but just how deeply ironic that is. The philosopher Martha Nussbaum says that the whole movement against equality, LGBT equality, like the whole idea that they should not be guaranteed equal rights is rooted in disgust. But that disgust, they do something that's icky. The way they have sex is weird and different. It seems so basic. But it's actually more profound than the cliche that, everyone who's homophobic is gay inside. That's not her point. But her point is that we tend to project what we're afraid of, what we find gross about our own selves, the fact that we have bodies that have functions that are messy or in some ways we don't want to admit. We project that onto someone outside of us, and we say they're the ones that are shameful.
I think it, as we're celebrating this day of hope, of new life, we need to remember that like what directly preceded that was a body that was bleeding and mutilated, that became a corpse. That people tended to that corpse, that even when Jesus was resurrected, that his wounds were still there, these kind of gross wounds, that that this claim of love and new life comes through that. The case in Indiana too, I think, points out this thing I was saying about testimony again, about how maybe we're not the best judges of certain deep parts of human experience. I think just like we need to rely on testimony sometimes for what's at the edge of death, we need to really learn, we need to recognize the testimony of people in society that are actually experiencing this shame, that are actually experiencing what it's like to be told they're disgusting, that we can't just think, we can't just have a rational thought about it. I think that's true in the race conversation as well. You'll often hear well-meaning white people say like, can't they just, things are better now, can't we get past it? Or people who say, I love the sinner, I just hate the sin. They need to, their whole point is they can't experience, they need to listen to these testimonies. A testimony of what it's really like to be the victim of that. Back to resurrection. I think, so this is the part where it comes back to I'm supposed to preach, I'm supposed to say, you know, on Easter Sunday, a minister or a preacher is supposed to say, like Tim said, Christ is risen. Like, supposed to give you this kind of certitude, this certitude that past this edge of terror, past this edge of disgust, this edge of we don't want to look, there's good news. And I'm going to try to do that, but in the way that only way that I can. I think the block for a lot of us to believing something as wild as the resurrection, or that death does not put a stop to meaning and love, the block is that, at least for me, is I don't want to sound like a fool. I don't want to sound like I'm not very smart. I don't want to sound like I believe in something just to kind of make me feel better. If you read enough sort of in the history of Western thought, you can get that impression that like the smart people saw through religion, these illusions, people like Marx and Nietzsche and Freud. I don't want to be one of those people who are duped. I don't want to be ashamed. And I want to tell you that like, don't be afraid, don't worry, just do it, just have faith, take the plunge, believe in God, it'll be okay. But it won't be okay, because you will be considered a dupe. You will be considered kind of simple-minded. If no one else, by me, I might think that of you sometimes. Because I think that of myself. A part of me thinks, what a moron. Like, you believe in this stuff that is not observable. And I think that if anyone tells you that a part of you, if you sort of start to believe in things that you can't prove, we'll always think that. Part of me will always think that about you, about myself. But I think what I'm saying today is that if you're open, and if you acknowledge you can't do it on your own, you can't think your way into it, you can't conjure the courage of facing death face in the eye, you can just like summon it, or conjure or summon up the the joy of knowing it's all good, it's going to be all right. What you can do is ask to be given those things. That asking puts us in a space of receptivity, so that when you're facing the door of death, the Department of Death, or Shame Headquarters, or Fear Central, whatever that door is, and it's starting to open, you'll still be afraid. You still want to turn away. But more and more, I think you'll hear a louder and louder voice saying, I gotcha. It's going to be all right. Amen.